Eat Drink Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Welcome to Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. We have got so much to talk about this week on Eat Drink Indie Radio. We have got a bit of the backstory on local chef Neil Brown's decision to close his popular Pizzology restaurant on Massachusetts Avenue and rebrand the space as a Southern European restaurant called Stella. We'll also talk about the upcoming James Beard Awards with Chef Alan Sternberg, who is a 2016 Beard semifinalist for Rising Star Chef of the Year. And we'll also hear more from Alan and his wife Audra about their new pop-up dinner series called Common House. And we'll finish up today with a conversation about coffee with Chris Kalander of Caffeine Coffee in Indianapolis. So stay with us for more on local food and drink here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Some of Indy's top chefs have been in the news the past couple of weeks with big changes for the local restaurant scene. Chef Greg Hardesty, a 5-time James Beard Awards semifinalist, announced that he is closing his award-winning restaurant Recess next weekend. And in an interesting twist, Chef Neil Brown, also a James Beard semifinalist and the owner of Pizzology and the Libertine Liquor Bar, will be taking over the Recess space for his new Japanese restaurant, Yukio. But then just this week, Brown also announced that he will be closing his Massachusetts Avenue Pizzology location and will reopen it next month as Stella, a Southern European-focused dinner-only restaurant. The Pizzology location in Carmel will stay open, and Brown explained why the locations are different and why he chose to rebrand on Mass Ave.
The decision to sort of open Stella, to close our chapter with Pizzology on Mass Ave, it wasn't necessarily a difficult decision, because what we had identified pretty early on was that Pizzology works really, really well in the suburbs. And in downtown, there's such competition for pizza. And pizza also has a different meaning downtown. Pizza is a significantly more casual food downtown, right? If people are eating out downtown and they're eating pizza, they're going for something very different than if they're going to one of the fine, you know, some great restaurant along Mass Ave or one of the restaurants downtown. Those are different experiences that people are seeking out, right? So the perception is that a pizza place is a pizza place. It's not a bad thing, right? It's not even that it bummed us out. It wasn't a disappointing thing, because we've always felt so good about our product. I mean, man, we stand behind our product. But it was just kind of like, man, we've got this great chef that's a young talent, and it's kind of like, what's going to serve us the best? You know, what's going to serve this location the best? And you know, you add everything up, and then you go from an opportunity cost standpoint, from a, you know, it's just like, man, it just makes more sense, you know. And so then you start thinking about, well, you know, once that thought crosses your mind that you might make a change, that's when the fun part starts to happen, right? Because then you start going, well, what would we do?
So Chef Neil Brown will be closing his Massachusetts Avenue Pizzology on February 19th with plans to reopen it in March as Stella. Concurrently, he'll be working to open Yukio at 49th and College Avenue. Very ambitious plans.
It's a monumental thing to do. We're opening a new restaurant. In fact, we're opening two restaurants at the same time.
Yeah, that's right. So talk about the timing of Yukio and Stella.
Parallel paths. Yeah.
Why not wait? Why do it all at once?
Because we like to challenge ourselves, you know? I mean, I like to challenge myself all the time. And I like to challenge these guys. We've got good people. When you've got good people, I couldn't do this. I can't say this enough. There's no way I would even consider doing this if I didn't think I had the team.
We've been talking with Chef Neil Brown of Pizzology in Carmel and the Libertine Liquor Bar on Mass Ave, which will soon be joined by Stella, and then Yukio at 49th and College. For more information, check out neilbrownhospitality.com. Jolene Ketzenberger, and we are back here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio. And since we've been speaking of local James Beard Restaurant and Chef Awards semifinalists, I just have to point out that it's almost time for this year's announcement. Beard Awards semifinalists will be announced February 15th, with the awards gala to take place in Chicago on May 1st. To talk a bit about the awards and what it's like to be a semifinalist and to actually attend the gala, I talked with Chef Alan Sternberg, executive chef at Cerulean Restaurant in Indianapolis and a 2016 semifinalist for Rising Star Chef of the Year. What about the Beard Awards? Are they relevant? Are they significant? Do they have an effect?
Yeah, I think they do for sure. I don't know. It's just recognition, I guess, and realizing that you are at a certain level in your career. For me, it was a big motivator. And it continues to be a big motivator. So going forward, it's just one of those things where you want to be recognized by your peers. You want to achieve greatness. You want to keep pushing forward. And the Beard Nom is definitely something that kind of helps motivate you to keep going. So as far as relevance, it's kind of the gold standard in the U.S. It's, you know, we don't have some of the guides that European countries do, and
right, like the Michelin Guide,
cities, right? Yeah, there's I think four right now. It's not relevant to everybody. The Beard Awards is, it's more of our country's recognition of culinary greatness and acclaim.
Well, sure, and they refer to them as the Oscars of the food world, so it is a very big deal. What did you think last year, you know, being recognized in the Rising Star category, which, of course, that's a national category in comparison to some of the regional categories that we have?
Yeah, so it completely caught me off guard. It's something I've been wanting for a long time and something I've kind of always been wanting to work towards and never thought I would actually get there, but it was definitely a surprise. And I mean, it's just pushed me even further this year. You know, it was one of those things where it's like, man, if people appreciate what we're doing now, like, we got to keep going. You know, we got to keep building on this. It's the beginning. It's never, you know, I don't look at an award as the end. I look at it as the next, like, step in the path. So
does it create some pressure for you? You know, as far as, here you are, a rising star.
I'm really not looking forward to the list this year. I'm super paranoid and terrified about it. But at the same time, you know, whether I'm there or not, it's, you know, there's a lot of good people out there. And just to ever be in the conversation alone is more than an honor in itself.
Now, talk a little bit about your progression and getting into the conversation. What's your background? Where do you come from as a chef?
So I started out in restaurants. I think I just turned 17. A friend asked me if I needed a job. I said yes. And I started washing dishes. And I'm from Anderson. So it was actually up there. Then I went to college and went to Ball State and ultimately dropped out of Ball State because I was skipping class to make sure I got to work, to make sure, like, my prep was done. And, you know, Audra, my wife, and I started a family about that same time, and it just kind of made sense to follow that route because, you know, it clearly was what I cared about way more than classwork or what I was studying to do professionally.
So how did you end up here in Indianapolis at Cerulean?
So I ran a little restaurant in downtown Muncie about 6 years ago now, and it closed. And Audra and I were talking, and we realized, like, to keep going, we had to move to a bigger city. Indy being the closest, and having a small child, two at the time, actually. Our son was just born. And it just made the most sense. We have family here. Both our families are from Anderson. So we had family around to help support us. And, you know, we wouldn't have had that if we went to Chicago or New York or San Francisco or New Orleans or anywhere else, really. So it just made sense to stay here because, I mean, we're both from here. We both grew up here. As much as I want to move somewhere else, like, I can't really picture myself not being in Indiana. So we made the move to Indy because it was the best fit for us.
Now, talk a little bit about the progression of Indianapolis dining and, you know, and the growing number of chefs that are getting acknowledged with things like the Beard Awards. Have you seen the progression?
I've definitely seen a progression. When I moved down here 5-6 years ago, there weren't a ton of options as far as good places to work. The kind of places that you want to work at to get to those higher levels. I see a lot more of that now. I see a lot more creative food. I see a lot more impassioned people, better sourcing, better products. I see a more engaged food community. So it's definitely progressed quite a bit in really a short time.
That engaged food community that you mentioned, that seems to have been a significant change.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, when we moved down here, we lived in Castleton. And anybody that's been to Castleton knows it's full of chain restaurants. There's not a lot of independents up there. You know, that was more the mentality. You know, when I first started working down here, I worked on the north side, and there was some challenges with the guests. You know, the way that they would order stuff, the modifications and whatnot.
Expectations.
Yeah, the expectations. You know, the food's too small and costs too much. It's like, no, that's what good food costs. Like, you know, it's not subsidized. Large farming. You know, it costs money to produce food. That's the reality. And you know, we've seen that population base that understand that grow. We've seen farmers markets pop up more and more. We see a very engaged crowd at the winter's farmers markets, and you know, they're spread out throughout the city, and there's farms that can support that. There's artisans that can support that, and I think that's a big infrastructure growth that we needed as a city. It's not just restaurants, it's the suppliers, it's the people that are willing to pay the money for it. It's a beer and wine community that's engaged, and a spirits community that's engaged. We need all those players. You know, we started to see some more butchers. We're mm-hmm. starting to see some farmers that are actually pursuing restaurants instead of just farmers markets, where they command more of a premium price than wholesale. So
that idea of infrastructure, that's very interesting. You know, that there has to be that infrastructure to grow the food community, not just the restaurants and chefs.
Yeah, I mean, it started probably 10 years ago, and we saw 3 culinary schools pop up in town at varying levels. And there was an influx of capable people in the workforce that were starting to understand food. And it's kind of just grown from there because, you know, those people need jobs. And, you know, out of every 100, you might find 10 that really kind of get it and want to push. And, you know, once you reach a certain number of people that are there, like, you got to go somewhere. So they started coming out of the few good restaurants, and they started opening their own restaurants and teaching that next wave. And, you know, they realized a need for those things. And I mean, capitalism's great because it, you know, ultimately, if somebody will need something and will pay money for it, like, somebody will go do it. But luckily, we've been able to nurture some relationships with great farmers and whatnot that really get it and care about everything just as much as we do.
Now, talk a little bit about the culture of the quality of food that you're talking about, the kind of restaurants that you're talking about. Talk a little bit about how you work with all of these aspects, you know, the bringing together the consumer and the farmer and the food, that sort of thing.
Being a chef's awesome because you're kind of that middle guy. You know, you can't make good food without great product to begin with. You know, it doesn't matter what the end dish is if you're using cheap, generic, whatever, because, you know, the flavor isn't going to be there. The passion's not going to be there. I think the most important ingredient we put in there is, you know, that kind of passion and pride. And it always helps to have those, the farmers or the suppliers that care on that same level. When you get to talk to them and they get so excited about something and they talk your ear off, and it, I mean, it's always great to kind of have that. But kitchen culture has changed a lot. Restaurant culture has changed a lot in the last 30 years, and it's become much more intellectual, I think, in a way. There's a lot of job changes, or a lot of career changes in the last 10 years or so, as you saw this huge rise in popularity of food as entertainment. And, I mean, we're talking on the radio right now because of food entertainment.
Exactly. The interest is
but,
there.
But at the same time, like, there's been a shift, you know. It's still a blue-collar job. It's still a lot of hard work. It's long hours. It's hot. You know, the likelihood of being cut or injured in some way is still there, very much the way that you have that in a factory. You know, it's still a production job. But with this influx of this white-collar mentality, the kitchen's got a little softer as far as the hard edges, you know. And at the same time, those discussions started to pop up more and more about, is this responsible? Is this sustainable? I think a lot of that comes from that influx of outside industry.
That change in the culture.
Yeah. You know, it's less yelling and screaming and throwing and whatnot, and it's much more talking and understanding and growing and mentoring.
Also talk a little bit about the entertainment aspect of it, because food has become entertainment. Do you see that as far as interest in the dining public?
It's a double-edged sword. I mean, it allows me my way of life. It allows me, you know, my job and my passion. But at the same time, we get faced with such scrutiny because everything looks great on a magazine. You can't taste it. I mean, you have no idea if that's good or bad. Like, you know, you Google a recipe and you blindly follow it, and you have no clue if it's good or bad. But at the same time, you take yourself as a professional or as a connoisseur, and, you know, you judge us by that. And that's, I mean, that happens in every industry, but, you know,
the greater scrutiny.
Yeah, right? We're never allowed a bad day.
Well, of course, nobody wants
a mistake. And
there,
that's not what I'm saying. I mean, it is what I'm saying, but it's not what I'm saying. You know, we get judged at a level that's so high because it is at the forefront of entertainment, you know.
That's true.
There's so, you know, I can make 10 dishes that taste like garbage, but if they look great on Instagram, like, you're going to be all about it. And, you know, it just kind of, it boggles my mind some days, and other days it's like, I get it, because, you know, I fall into that same rabbit hole where I just, you know, flip through Instagram or flip through Facebook or whatever. I'm just like, dang, that looks... That looks good.
Now, what was it like attending the Beard Awards? Because you've been to the Beard Awards a couple of times, and seen all those famous names up close and personal. What was that like?
So, been twice now, both times in Chicago. 2 years ago, it was the first time I remember being really starstruck. Anyone and everybody, every book that I have on my shelf, I saw the chef that wrote it. I mean, it was overwhelming for sure. But at the same time, kind of realized, like, you're one of a thousand there. They don't know who you are. They're not going to remember you. You snag that picture, like, and it's yours forever. And they're never going to remember it. And, you know, I've never been like that in my life. It was a crazy night. And it was so motivating, you know, to see so many of my heroes. To me, it really helped push. It kind of focuses me, you know. All those things kind of, I use them all as a lens to kind of focus down and say, all right, I'm on the right path, or no, I'm not. Like, I need to adjust. And not to say I'm just chasing an award either, but it does mean something. I mean, it does. It gets me excited. You know, I want to be part of that crowd. I don't think there's anything wrong with wanting to be that part of that. It just kind of keeps me going and gets me out of bed in the mornings.
We've been talking with Chef Alan Sternberg of Cerulean Restaurant in Indianapolis. You can check out ceruleanrestaurant.com/Indianapolis. And for more information about the chef and his new pop-up dinner series, which we'll be talking about in just a few moments, check out commonhouseindy.com. Can safely say that there has never been a better time to dine out in Indianapolis than right now. The city and its chefs and restaurants are getting national attention, and here locally, diners have more restaurant choices than ever before. They also have new options for special dining events, like pop-up dinners from local chefs. These one-time dinners often feature a specific theme or take place in an unusual space or include out-of-town chefs. The idea in all of these cases is to offer the diner a unique experience. To that end, local chef Alan Sternberg of Cerulean Restaurant in Indianapolis, a 2016 James Beard Award semifinalist for Rising Star Chef of the Year, along with his wife, Audra, have created a pop-up dinner series called Common House. I talked with Alan and Audra about coming up with the Common House concept and what diners can expect at a Common House event.
Last year, I got a couple opportunities to go travel around a good bit and cook around the country. And by around the country, I mean like 4 or 5 states,
right.
But more than I had before. I got to meet some really cool people and, you know, got to see some different things. And I think there's a level of excitement when new things come about or when you just don't have the expectation and then you stumble upon them. There's always something rewarding.
So you cooked at the James Beard House in New York City. You did some dinners in other states with other chefs.
Yeah.
And that makes a difference?
It totally does. Each new place you cook in has their own challenges. And trying to figure out the best way to work with those challenges and not knowing the equipment, not knowing the people you're cooking with and trying to collaborate amongst yourselves and seeing different perspectives, you know. And I think so much of the time I get focused on my perspective because that's the only perspective I know. But, like, when you start to see other people's perspectives, it kind of just says, oh, man, we should take a step back and look at a bigger picture here.
You know, how they do things and their point of view, that sort of thing?
Yeah, for sure. And so one of those epiphanies was – in St. Louis, some of the chefs there were kind of stirring the pot a little bit by doing these dinner series outside of the restaurants and really kind of challenging the status quo. And, I mean, St. Louis has a great food scene, but it just kind of dawned on me as, like, I felt like I was waiting for people to ask me too much instead of going and doing on my own and realizing how much fun I could just have.
Creating a special series of dinners on
your own. Yeah. You know, I love what I do at the restaurant and it's definitely my main focus, but there's things I can't do there because, you know, our restaurant has 100 seats and,
sure.
You know, there's P&Ls we have to be accountable for. And, you know, once we remove some of those constraints, it kind of frees me up quite a bit to experiment and play and really kind of grow for me instead of, you know, just for the restaurant.
So how would a pop-up dinner series help you do that? What's freeing about that?
I'm not really accountable to anything as long as I don't lose money. I mean, Audra and I kind of agreed from day one is, you know, this isn't really about making money. This is about, you know, covering our costs at most, really.
And growth, personal growth?
Yeah. I mean, Audra's been a lot more involved in the restaurant lately. And, you know, we saw it as a way for us to work together and to grow both as a couple and professionally. And
Well, Audra, tell me what it's been like creating or helping to create a new pop-up dinner series.
Oh man. First of all, it's just exciting to do it with your husband. There's a
so exciting.
It's fun to watch him get excited in a different way than just day to day from the restaurant, and that it's contagious. And so I get to see more of what he does in a different level and work with him, and it's just brought us closer in a different way. I mean, we work at the restaurant together, but this is more about being creative with him.
And so now tell me about the first one, the first dinner that you held. Where was that? How was that?
So it was at Wildwood Market in Fountain Square. And it's a very small place. So if you've ever been there, it's a very small market. So we had to basically create a dining room because there's shelves everywhere now. So we made a very intimate dining feeling of it. You know, when you walk in, there's just one giant table. And everyone, it was very communal, so everybody sat around talking. You could be right there with them through the whole dinner. There was Alan. I was right there. And you got to just look around at each face and see everyone having a really good time. And that's what is special.
So what was the reaction? The first one was certainly sold out, right?
It felt like you went to dinner at someone's home. It felt like you were at a friend's house. People were sharing stories. Talking across the table. We had a farmer there that we were using their meat, Becker, Kyle Becker. So he could tell stories about his animals. You know, they got to ask questions. It was a mixed bag of people, but everyone found something to talk about, and that was really special.
So now, where's the dinner series going from here? You have another one coming up very soon, right?
Yeah, so the next one's the 19th of February. Sold out, and it's going to be at the Plow and Anchor. Or formerly Plow and Anchor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we are trying to keep these really small. I would much rather add a second day than add lots more seats.
So how large is it?
So this one's going to be 18. The first one was 16, right? The Wild one was 16. And I need to say a quick thank you to Craig and his wife for letting us use their fabulous little store. But Plow and Anchor is going to be 18. The theme's roots. You know, we're trying to put a theme to every dinner, and we're not trying to take it too serious. There's definitely some more abstract ideas coming down the line as we kind of build some trust and build some faith with our clientele. And you know, we just want to have fun. You know, that's what it's all about is creating a small, intimate setting where people can come relax and enjoy themselves and, you know, share in our story and to tell them a story. And, you know, food's my medium for pretty much everything in life. I'm way more social on a plate than I am in person. And
that's an interesting concept. So people will get some understanding of you as a person from your food.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of where it stemmed from. You know, I was looking to have fun and really push myself this year and not having the constraints of a restaurant. It was very liberating. The first one was very liberating. And you know, our theme then was a market because we were going to be doing a dinner in a market. Like Audra said, Kyle Becker was there. It was my first farmer I ever worked with in Muncie.
Oh, that's very cool.
And he's coming to this next one, and you know, he just sent me a text the other day. He's like, "What do you need for the dinner?" And so like that relationship still grows, and it's been ultimately really rewarding to be able to do this on my own and to do it with Audra, and you know, Caleb's been really supportive. My boss at the restaurant. You know, it's not a conflict for us. It's a continuation of what we preach at the restaurant about community and joy and personal growth. So it still works in a really nice way.
And now tell me how a pop-up series works, kind of the nuts and bolts of it. It's a ticketed event, right? And people sign up ahead of time.
Yeah. So right now, we're just using Eventbrite. We looked at a couple different places as far as how we could sell tickets to the event, and Eventbrite was the most user friendly for us.
Mm-hmm. So people can go online and, yep. and look for it?
Yep. We just started a mailing list, an email list, so we can announce. We're not going to announce a dinner until the day after we're done with one.
Right.
Because I think we sell a dinner short if we try to conceive too far ahead.
So you can experience the one that you're into at the moment,
yeah.
right?
And you know, it comes down to the whole, if I plan something 6 months from now, and hopefully I'm in a way better place than I was, you know, now, you know, hopefully I'm doing better stuff and my level of thinking is at least marginally better.
So it would be completely different then.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, there's, you know, I look through my old books and my notebooks, and I just look at some of the ideas. I'm like, what was I thinking?
So you can see your progression.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I do that with the menus too. You know, between the restaurant and different events, and you know, looking back through Instagram or Facebook or whatever, I'm just like, ugh. A lot of cringeworthy moments for myself there.
So, what about this? Seems to be part of growing the infrastructure that you talked about, developing. The dining public, kind of bringing them along with you. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, we talked fairly recently about, you know, the city has grown so much, and you know, I feel like in a way we've all kind of pat ourselves on the back and said, you know, we're there, and
we have gotten a lot of attention lately.
We have got a lot of attention, and I think part of being there is continuing to go and continuing to push and not, you know, relishing that victory, but at the same time set new goals. And for me, this was setting a new goal, you know, a new year, new goal. And so far, I mean, we've been able to accomplish a lot in really a short amount of time, and I want to keep that going. I don't want to ever fall down. I'm going to fall down, but I don't want to get burnt out and slow down and not want to push and not want to keep getting better. You know, if I can do one little thing better each day, you know, over a lifetime, I'm going to be pretty good at something.
Now, Andre, tell me about where people can find out some more information about Common House, maybe a few details, or sign up for your newsletter.
So you can go to commonhouseindy.com. Right on the front page is a mailing list. You can just type your email in there, and we will be sending out an email probably the day after this upcoming dinner about the next dinner. So that'll give you an option to buy tickets. We have an Eventbrite page as well, which is linked through our website. We are on Instagram, we're on Facebook and Twitter, just Common House Indy.
We've been talking with Alan and Audra Sternberg of Common House, a new pop-up dinner series in Indianapolis. For more information, check out commonhouseindy.com or look for it on Facebook. Local restaurant community, the Central Indiana coffee scene continues to grow. We're seeing more and more roasters, and the appreciation of artisanal or third wave coffee continues to grow as well. And that creates room for a variety of different coffee shops. Caffeine Coffee, owned by Chris and Amanda Killander, focuses on coffees and coffee drinks from around the world. I stopped in at Caffeine Coffee, which is tucked away in a bit of an industrial area just off Massachusetts Avenue, and talked with Chris about the backstory of Caffeine Coffee, from its coffee truck beginnings to the world of coffee you can find at the shop.
The backstory of Caffeine is I've been doing coffee for a good time now, at least 18, 20 years. I helped run a couple coffee shops. I've designed a few coffee shops, or more than a few. And so everything from, you know, water systems to espresso machines. And then about 2008, after a few health issues, we decided to open up a coffee truck. So around 2008, I started actually building it out. Took me a little while to get the truck going. So I think we were on the street around 2010, roughly. And
now, what was the atmosphere here around 2010? What were you experiencing?
Well, in coffee, there wasn't much at all at that point. There were your typical coffee shops. There was definitely no third wave coffee yet. There was not a lot of people. There wasn't any artisanal roasters, I should say, or if I could call them that. There wasn't a lot of artisanal shops. There were your straightforward coffee shops. I think that as far as the truck scene goes, we were just getting into the truck scene. We had West Coast Tacos, I believe, on the streets, and we didn't have a whole lot of rules on trucks at that point. I think Mark Mitchell was one of the original guys that was helped write some of the rules for food trucks. So it was kind of an open scene at that time. We were just able to go where we wanted and do what we wanted. And so that was fun times. We actually could take the truck downtown. We would open up and serve coffee at events, parties, festivals. So that's where we really got our feet wet as far as our menu items. So we were really developing our special blends of beans that we use for our caffeine blend, and a lot of people were loving it. We saw the response through the truck, and then we, at that point, we were starting to introduce new drinks as we were experiencing them ourselves. So whether it was, you know, an Italian Bicherine, or whether it was an Antochino or things like that, those were all drinks that we were starting to implement on the truck.
So where did it go from there? You know, what was the progression?
Yeah, the progression of the truck was, I mean, we saw an influx at that point of people really loving what we were doing with coffee. So it was at that point we almost said, you know, the truck is a great thing, but it's also a great marketer. So the idea of that being the full bread and butter, we wanted a much bigger picture than that. We wanted a place that people could come and sit down and experience coffee. So it was at that point that we decided that we need to look for a location. We had gone through a couple different locations, a couple places that we hoped or thought would work out. Those locations didn't work out, but we happened to come upon our current location at 707 Fulton. So it's a great area. It's still kind of an industrial area. I kind of compare it to the Meatpacking District of New York, where Stella McCartney came in and kind of revitalized the area, and restaurants started coming in and all that kind of stuff. So I kind of see this area as people like it and they're drawn to it because it's industrial, but yet it's still so close to Mass Avenue.
It's, you know, what people would say is off the beaten path, certainly, but still kind of right in the middle of everything.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that people like the idea that they're, because, I mean, it is an area that people still like to walk. I mean, you know, we have Indie Fringe at the end of the street, and we have apartments right across the way from us, which are just right off of College. And I think that those people love the idea. And actually, true, we have a lot of doctors. We have a lot of people from the hospital who may come in, grab their stuff, and go. And people come and just meet friends. So I think that it is a good location to stop, grab, and go versus having to maybe sometimes fight some of the parking issues that you may see.
And you are right off of the highway, you know, so it's an interesting little area.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. I think that that's one thing that is kind of getting this end of Mass Avenue going, is that it is so close to the interstate, and that, you know, it's almost like it's being developed as now the entrance to Mass Avenue versus the opposite end of Mass Avenue.
Now that's interesting, because you know you're down sort of at the toward the, what would people would see the end of Mass Ave, but maybe it's the beginning.
Yeah, I think it may be. Just from some of the knowledge that I have received lately, is that, you know, we have the new it was the Credit Union, you know, parking area and that, and we've got, you know, some of the restaurants on this corner, but, you know, and hopefully, you know, this intersection will change obviously for traffic purposes, but I think that we definitely see that this may be kind of the new entrance of Mass Avenue.
So as even our perceptions are changing about the area and how people use it and interact with the area, how are things changing with how people view coffee here in Indianapolis?
Well, I think coffee is definitely finally getting the limelight it deserves. I think that, you know, especially what's happening with the food industry, you know, we see a lot of awards going, you know, coming to chefs and whatnot. And for that matter, I think, you know, I'm an artist. You know, I went to art school, but so I'm always one to push the envelope. So to see the food industry being pushed, I definitely still see there's room to push coffee, which is what we're trying to create, bring that edge to coffee, or bringing a new level to coffee. But I definitely see that the city in general is really doing a better job of bringing coffee to the limelight, in the sense of matching it up. If you want to call it pairing, you can, and trying to bring it to the same level as the attitude of food that we're having here.
So that coffee is part of the culinary scene.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, in some cities, it's even much greater than it is here. I mean, you know, Portland, Seattle, I mean, those places, it really definitely is, I mean, it's intertwined.
Oh, absolutely. So, as it's developing here in Indianapolis, what are you hoping to accomplish, you know, with Caffeine Coffee?
Well, I think the first thing is that when we, and some of the reaction we've already gotten from it is that when people walk in the door, they obviously know immediately that there's something different about it. So I think we have a certain responsibility to live up to that. And so what we're trying to do is make sure that we try to broaden the horizon, as well as educate when needed, because we don't feel like we necessarily have to push it on people, but a lot of people that come to us are the type of individuals that just love to learn about coffee, you know, and there's a lot to learn. Trust me, I'm learning every day. But for somebody to come in and say, okay, caffeine's different, I hope to have a different experience, that's what we want. So we do drinks, we try to concentrate on drinks from around the world. We have what's called our World of Coffee drinks, which is, if you were to go to Torino, Italy, you would get the exact same drink that you may experience in Torino, Italy, or in Madrid, or, you know, any of those drinks. So we try to really focus on the bigger picture of coffee from around the world, not just Indianapolis.
We've been talking with Chris Calander of Caffeine Coffee. Stay with us for more from Chris here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Well, there's certainly more to coffee than a morning jumpstart. But how do you go about learning about the world of coffee? That's what Caffeine Coffee in Indianapolis is there for. Owner Chris Calander and the Caffeine Baristas focus on education. You can stop into the shop located at 707 Fulton Street in Indianapolis and try a type of coffee or coffee drink that you've likely never had before and maybe brewed in a completely different way. Or you can grab a quick cup. Chris fills us in on what's up at Caffeine Coffee.
Obviously, one of our main goals, which obviously to try to broaden the spectrum of coffee or the knowledge of coffee, is that not only, you know, one thing is we have a big map on the wall, and that map, it shows the coffee belt. So, you know, a lot of people may come in and experience a coffee, and or maybe they don't even care, but sometimes I see that glitter in their eye about, oh, now I can learn about where my coffee comes from. I'm just not getting a cup of coffee. I can understand where it comes from. So for us, we take that as that's very important to us. So we see that when we can educate people as far as the coffee belt and where those coffees come from, and the appellation of coffee is something that people take seriously, just like they do wine. So if you're talking about the meters above sea level that a coffee is grown to the altitude, you know, the higher a coffee is grown, the sweeter it can be. So with those type of things, when we can show people where their coffee comes from, the characteristics of the coffee, I think that they really enjoy that, and that's part of the experience. So we have a training program that trains all of our baristas and all of our employees to make sure that they can explain the coffees, talk about the coffees, and then in return communicate that to the customer. Because a lot of our drinks are drinks that some of the customers may never have had before. So we want to make sure that they understand what they're getting, and especially that they enjoy it. So,
well, now, what do you mean that they may never have had before? Get a little specific about that.
Yeah, so to get a little bit more specific, you know, there may be, you know, a drink like a Spanish latte, which may have a few extra ingredients in it that they've never had in a latte before, or it may be a Vietnamese coffee. So a Vietnamese coffee, is brewed in a specific brewer that is extremely popular in Vietnam. I mean, they use it every morning, but it also uses two special coffees that are usually not seen in the United States. So to let people know that coffee has maybe a unique flavor to it is something we want them to know ahead of time, but that they're also going to experience something maybe new in coffee that they haven't tried before.
Now, that's part of your education focus. How do you teach people about coffee without being, you know, without hitting them over the head with it?
Right. Well, I think that being in this area is also a part of it, is that it's a very urban, hip area. It's an area that people are willing to, they want to learn, just like they do the food. I mean, that's why we see a lot of the restaurants. So a lot of people come in. So a lot of people will come in and you can kind of sense, it's kind of that barista, you know, vibe that you get is that you can tell that people are wanting to learn. So you may give them a little information. Some people may not push the envelope and they may ask more questions. So we try to educate or say, hey, you know, that's a drink that comes from Vietnam. I don't know if you've had it before. And we kind of base it on their reaction. You know, and just letting people know, you know, hey, sometimes we try to boil it down too, because sometimes it's nice to direct people the first time. So, you know, whether that's buying, you know, a flight of beans, we call it, which is you can buy a small amount of beans and try one every day at home. So instead of getting a pound, you can try 7 different coffees for each day of the week and then jot down with our note cards which coffee you like. So for us to get somebody to the register and say, well, what do you like? Do you like sweet? Do you like a strong coffee flavor, which would be an espresso-based drink? Or do you like a tea? Because we do a lot of teas as well. So being able to narrow down what somebody wants, you start feeling, hey, can I give a little more information to this person? Can I steer them in a way that they may not? Because we love people trying new things that they never tried and then coming back to us and saying, that was awesome.
Now, what about the person who just comes in and they just want to get a cup of coffee? Is it overwhelming to them? Is it is it easy to start somewhere? You know, if they haven't been exploring coffee in the past?
Yeah. I think that's and actually that may I think it's really easy to do actually. And the reason I say it is because we have our caffeine blend of coffee, which we've been extremely lucky with. It was a happenstance blend that we came up with. It works well in multiple areas. So if somebody comes in and they want a cup of coffee, and you know if they're still okay with a medium to bold coffee, we will immediately give them the caffeine blend. Usually we do have another option that you can have, which is usually a lighter roast that's always on tap. But once they experience, because a lot of people have never experienced necessarily fresh coffee, so if you're talking about coffee that was roasted 2 days ago, which is the average time after roasting, you should let it sit for a little while. When they have the caffeine blend, everybody loves it. I haven't had anybody say they don't like it. And that's just because I think, for one reason, I mean, we could find a better coffee that they may like, but the freshness of the coffee alone is something is unique that they may not have had before. So with that said, I think for the person just coming in getting a cup of coffee, I think it's I think it's easy for a lot of people to do once they've done it. They realize that they can come in, get a very well-roasted, fresh cup of coffee, and they don't have to experiment if they don't want to. And a lot of people don't. In the mornings, some people come, they grab and go. So, but they also love the idea that they have also different options because, you know, at any given time, we have 11 different coffees from around the world. So we'll definitely find something that somebody likes for sure.
Now, how do you lead people into a greater appreciation of the coffees from around the world? Are there ways people can come and taste different things and kind of explore a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, we currently we're not doing it right now. We're trying to ramp up to this, but we do what we call tastings. We don't necessarily I used to do in-home parties where I used to go to people's houses and show them how to brew. So what we plan to do here is do the same type of things in-house, and not necessarily a cupping, because a cupping is something that a roaster would do. In our case, we want to do tastings, which we would still do them in-house right now. But our goal is to, for somebody that wants to have to understand how the details of coffee and how the complexities of coffee. You know, we can brew coffee at least 8 different ways. So we have a mocha pot, a V60, a Chemex. I mean, we go on and on and on with our brewing process. So, but each individual coffee can taste different in each one of those brewing processes. So to be able to have customers come in that we find want to learn about coffee and be able to say, you know, hey, this is a coffee, and I don't know if you knew, but, you know, it can taste differently in each brewing process, and this is why. So, and we like to explain that to people. You know, people will say, well, why does it taste different in that contraption versus that contraption? And we'll say, well, it's because of this. So we really try to get to the science of coffee. You know, how much sugars are in coffee. We use things like a refractometer to measure the amounts of sugar after a coffee is brewed, to testing our water. So a lot of those things customers really, they appreciate. I think if it's the person that really likes to hear about it, I think they really appreciate the time that is spent. And I think that's what kind of sets us apart, is that we focus on this every day, all day. We don't do anything else but coffee. So we try to, every step of the way, we always look at what we're doing and make sure we're doing it to the best of our ability at that moment.
We've been talking with Chris Kalander of Caffeine Coffee in Indianapolis. For more information, check out Caffeine, that's K-A-F-F-E-I-N-E, coffee.com. I'm Jolene Katzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, and Do Radio on WFYI HD2, The Point. Thank you so much for tuning into our show this week, and thanks also to our guests, Chef Neil Brown of Pizzology and the Libertine Liquor Bar, and to come, Yukio and Stella. Thanks also to Alan and Audra Sternberg of Cerulean Restaurant and Common House. And thanks to Chris Kalander of Caffeine Coffee in Indianapolis. And thanks also to producer John Katzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indie Radio.